Kath did say last week in her introduction that we're starting a new series on the Ten Commandments. And after her introduction last week, this is the first actual commandment we're going to look at. If you weren't here and don't know which one it's going to be, I'm not going to say yet, because we're going to play Spot the Commandment. Phil, reading please.
We did wonder about putting you down for this one. Right, so the reading, given that he's preaching on the Ten Commandments, is not from the Ten Commandments, it's from 2 Samuel chapter 11. And we're going to read verses 1 to 15, and then jump to verse 26 and take it through to chapter 12, verse 7. So it's David and Bathsheba. Right, here we go. In the spring, at the time when kings go off to war, David sent Joab out with the king's men and the whole Israelite army. They destroyed the Ammonites and besieged Rabbah, but David remained in Jerusalem. Now one evening, David got up from his bed and walked around on the roof of the palace. From the roof, he saw a woman washing. The woman was very beautiful, and David sent someone to find out about her. The man said, "She's Bathsheba, the daughter of Eliam and the wife of Uriah the Hittite." Then David sent messengers to get her. She came to him, and he slept with her. Now she was purifying herself from her monthly uncleanness, and then she went back home. The woman conceived and sent word to David, saying, "I'm pregnant." So David sent this word to Joab: "Send me Uriah the Hittite." And Joab sent him to David. And when Uriah came to him, David asked him how Joab was, how the soldiers were, and how the war was going. Then David said to Uriah, "Go down to your house and wash your feet." So Uriah left the palace, and a gift from the king was sent after him. But Uriah slept at the entrance to the palace with all his master's servants and did not go down to his house. But David was told Uriah did not go home. So he asked Uriah, "Haven't you just come from a military campaign? Why didn't you go home?" And Uriah said to David, "The ark and Israel and Judah are staying in tents. And my commander Joab and my lord's men are camped in the open country. How could I go to my house to eat and drink and make love to my wife? As surely as you live, I will not do such a thing." Then David said to him, "Stay here one more day, and tomorrow I'll send you back." So Uriah remained in Jerusalem that day and the next. And at David's invitation, he ate and drank with him, and David made him drunk. But in the evening, Uriah went out to sleep on his mat among the master's servants. He did not go home. Then in the morning, David wrote a letter to Joab and sent it with Uriah. In it he wrote, "Put Uriah out in front where the fighting is fiercest. Then withdraw from him so that he will be struck down and die." I jump into verse 26. When Uriah's wife heard that her husband was dead, she mourned for him. After the time of mourning was over, David had her brought to his house, and she became his wife and bore him a son. But the thing David had done had displeased the Lord. The Lord said to David, Nathan the prophet, when he came to him, he said, There were two men in a certain town, one rich and the other poor. The rich man had a very large number of sheep and cattle, but the poor man had nothing except one little ewe lamb that he had bought. He raised it, and it grew up with him and his children. It shared his food, drank from his cup, and even slept in his arms. It was like a daughter to him. Now a traveller came to the rich man, but the rich man refrained from taking one of his own sheep or cattle to prepare a meal for the traveller who had come to him. Instead, he took the ewe lamb that belonged to the poor man and prepared it for the one who had come. David burned with anger against this man and said to Nathan, "As surely as the Lord lives, the man who did this must die. He must pay for that lamb four times over because he did such a thing and had no pity." Then Nathan said to David, "You are that man." This is the word of the Lord.
Well, shall we continue to play Spot the Commandment? Thank you. Okay, there are at least 3.5 options, answers to which commandment we're looking at today. Any guesses? There's only 10 to choose from, so, you know, a guess isn't a bad... Yes? Obeying your Lord? It's a possibility, but it's not what I'm looking for. Thank you, that's another one.
Don't covet.
Any rot and murder. We've got 3.5, we've got them there. So, yes, we had a situation where there's murder, there's adultery, there's implicit deceit in the way that David was dealing with Uriah, trying to get him back to his house. But they all start at the beginning because David coveted literally his neighbour's wife. And the full verse we're looking at today then is Exodus 20:17. "You shall not covet your neighbour's house. You shall not covet your neighbour's wife or his male or female servant, his ox or donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbour." Now, there's good news and there's bad news. The good news is, of the 7 things that we shouldn't do, most of them, 4 of them, shouldn't be a problem. Unless your neighbour's got an ox, a donkey, or a maidservant or a manservant. The bad news is that the last one, which is don't cover anything your neighbour has, covers everything. And it's not just your next door neighbour, it's anyone pretty much. I must say, sorry for digress here, but I was looking for pictures to illustrate. There's obviously no photograph of David and Bathsheba, so I had to go to artwork. And it's like playing Where's Wally? You spotted David up in the top corner there. Over. And every picture I looked at, David's just at the top left-hand corner. So while we're in the mood for playing games, if you want to go home and Google David and Bathsheba, look at all the pictures and see if you can find him anywhere apart from that top left corner, lurking as he does. I hope I'm not splitting hairs this morning, but just to say in advance of what we're going to talk about, there's a massive overlap between covetousness and materialism. Very, very big overlap. But I'm not talking about materialism and greed per se this morning. Covetousness is a little bit more specific in that it's not just wanting lots of stuff, it's particularly wanting what someone else has already got. So to David, I mean, he had everything he could want, didn't he? He was the king, he was the undisputed king. It'd been a while to get to that stage. He was the most powerful man in the land. He already had at least 3 wives. He was admired by the nation. God was blessing virtually everything he did. And he had some very loyal friends and staff. Great situation to be in. Maybe he had some marital problems. His first wife, the one given to him by Saul's daughter, she was moaning at him when he came into Jerusalem with the Ark of the Covenant and was dancing because she said he was undignified. So there may have been some tension there. Becca preached a few weeks ago about Abigail, and she was married in the past to a very rich man. So when he died and David married her, maybe it was convenient, you know, keep her in the lifestyle to which she'd been accustomed. So maybe it wasn't love there. But none of this excuses David for what he did. Nathan's parable makes that so clear. David coveted a woman he saw bathing. That's the bottom line. He invited her to the palace. Now, perhaps I might be wrong, but perhaps he invited her in to say how lovely her towels were. Maybe he invited her in to say how refreshing it can be on a hot Middle Eastern afternoon or evening to have a cool bath. But no, I don't think so. He invited her to the palace with one thing in mind. Bearing in mind he's the king, basically, he raped her. So we're starting off with rape, because she couldn't say no to the king. When it became clear she was pregnant, David panicked. He was disingenuous with his loyal soldier, Uriah. Just to make it look like Uriah was going to be the father of the child and not David. And then when all of those ruses didn't work, he betrayed him and had him deliberately killed. Now, David didn't shoot the arrow, but he might as well have done. It's a litany of sin. But that's 3,000 odd years ago. Let's move up to date. Bigger picture. And I would say that Vladimir Putin's land grab in Ukraine is a similar situation in a way. It's to covetousness with just a little sprinkling of pride added on top. Because he signed a treaty saying that Ukraine was free and independent, and ever since then he wanted to bring it back. He was greedy for that land. And again, the implication for that, or the working out of that, has meant death, destruction, damage, terrible grief. And there's all sorts of knock-on effects around the world. But he's a man of power. He's already rich. He should be satisfied with what he has. As well as his status, we don't know exactly how rich he is, but some people think he's probably the richest man in the world. Officially, he's on $140,000 per year, only owns an 800 square foot apartment in Moscow and three cars. But one perpetual calendar watch alone that he's publicly seen wearing is a 60 grand item. And it's unthinkable that he's created this safety network of billionaire oligarchs around him without him having some sort of similar wealth. And according to the federal.com, which as far as I can work out is rated as a reputable news source and fortune, the mansion that we see here reportedly has a helicopter launch pad, underground tunnels, a marble swimming pool, amphitheater, ice hockey rink, Vegas-style nightclub and more, including $850 toilet brushes and a £1,250 toilet roll holder or two. The landscape maintenance alone is £2 million a year, or dollars a year. That is known as Putin's palace. And for all that, actually, he never looks very happy, and he's absolutely paranoid about security. So his covetousness, as a rich man who wants even more, has led to heartbreaking amounts of death and destruction in Ukraine, but also his work in Africa, where he's propping up unpopular regimes in return for their mineral wealth, which he takes back to Russia to fund all this sort of stuff, again causes poverty and misery in all places around the world. So covetousness, not a good thing. And I think we know, probably each of us has either a close family member or a close friend who suffered because our covetousness has led to lust, has led to a breakdown of a relationship, and people have suffered. So I don't think I need to say any more about the dangers of covetousness. But there is actually, I have found one thing which isn't a danger. It has been used for good. Captain Cook, the explorer, saved his crew's lives by manipulating their urges. He wanted to protect them from scurvy, which was a horrible death that a lot of sailors suffered in the 1700s. And the cause was unknown, but he noticed on a lot of German ships where they were fed sauerkraut, they never got scurvy. So he provided sauerkraut for all of his staff, but none of them ate it. So what he did, he solved the problem by putting platters of sauerkraut on the officers' tables and saying that the minions could help themselves if they wanted to. Well, of course, if the officers have it, I'll have it too. So everyone helped themselves, and they never had scurvy. So he solved the problem of their vitamin C deficiency, because we so often want what other people have. So let's look at God's heart, because I'll always come back to this question when we look at anything. What is God's heart for the world? That frames it for me, because this is where our hearts should be also. And one commentator, and I apologise, I haven't noted who it was that I found, but he said this, or she said this, about the 10th commandment, that it could be to make clear God's intent for Israel to be self-governing. Each community member was to respect the lives and property of other members of the community as obedience to himself. This command not to covet closes any potential loopholes that might be crafted to avoid the 6th through to the 9th commandments. It makes clear that each community member is to protect, as well as serve, the best interests of their fellow community members. And the blessing God promised for obedience would, in large part, flow directly from the obedience. Because any community made up of people who treat each other in this manner will be a delightful and productive place in which to live. And God's heart is always for people to thrive, for communities to be marked by shalom, for all lives to be grounded in God's love, flowing into them and flowing out to others. And actually, if we want to bring it to the New Testament, just to reinforce that, Jesus' teaching echoes this. It's dotted throughout the Sermon on the Mount and his parables, and particularly when Jesus was asked what the greatest commandment is. He didn't choose any of the 10, but he summarized them. I think Cass said this last week, that the first law summarizes the first 5 commandments and the second 5. It says, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind. This is the first and greatest commandment. And the second is like it. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. On these 2 commandments, the law and the prophets depend." So that's the big one. Love your neighbor as yourself. Don't hanker after all their stuff. So how do we respond? I actually struggle to work out how to organize this part because everything overlaps with everything else. So I just, in desperation, Googled the words thankfulness, gratitude, and gratitude, contentment, and trust, and came up with this. This says, thankfulness and gratitude generate contentment that causes peace. It's a little bit stretched out because I think gratitude and thankfulness are the same thing. But thankfulness and gratitude generate contentment that causes peace. And contentment is what I've called this talk. Be contented, not don't covet, but be contented. Same thing, 2 sides of the coin. It's the positive spin on don't covet. Find contentment, because then the root of that covetousness will dissipate. So, these 19 blocks represent the countries of the world. There's 192 countries, I believe. So, each block represents 10 countries. The poorest on the left, the richest on the right. Ignore the green for now, that's for the next slide. So, under 92 countries, where would you like to be in that poorest to richest situation? Anyone want to stab a guess at that? No right or wrong, it's just where you particularly want to be. I'm guessing everyone wants to be on the right half, is that correct? The richest half? Yeah? Probably 3/4 of the way is not bad because it's not too greedy, but it's comfortable. Well, actually, we are there. The top of the 19 bands we are in. And because I haven't got room on the slide to show 192 countries, I've taken those green ones at the very top, the top 36 countries, and if you look at them, we are then up there. So we are the 8th richest country based on household income out of the 192 countries in the world. I think that alone is pretty something to be thankful for. And if those bars sort of show proportions of wealth, and when you get to the really thin one here, that's Turkey at 36, Democratic Republic of Congo is at the very bottom, is a 1/6 of that. That's the discrepancy in the riches of the world. So the very start of it, our problems are, as we say, first world problems. But bearing in mind that list goes all the way down to about here, if you had all 192, how often as a culture do we look up at those top 7 above us? For example, if you watch a program like Escape to the Country, you might have a lovely 7-acre garden in Wiltshire or somewhere looking over a lake. You don't get offered a shack in the Congo because we don't think about all of those below us. We're taught as a culture to just dream of what those others above us have got, even though there's very few above us and many, many below. See, we only have one pair of eyes. If we're looking at our neighbour's stuff, we can't see the good stuff we've already got. If we're looking at the good stuff we've already got, we can't be hankering after our neighbour's stuff. Where are we going to focus our thoughts? So the first thing we can do is to take time to be thankful for what we have, what God's blessed us with. Not just things, but relationships, or intellectually, practically, physically, spiritually. Thank God for those things. It's a bit like saying grace before a meal, but throughout our lives. So thankful the car starts. Thank you the computer works. Thank you that God's got me out of a hole at work. Thank you that we have senses that appreciate incredible beauty around us. We hear music. Things we've got all of the time. Let's be thankful for those. And develop in ourselves a culture of gratitude and thankfulness. As that line said, thankfulness and gratitude generate contentment that causes peace and dissipates covetousness. So contentment, the eagle-eyed of you may have noticed we had this slide at the start. Any idea why? Yes, it proves, look, the grass isn't greener on that side as it is on this side of the fence. It's the same. I came across an image that was saying, the grass is greener where you water it, anonymous. So I wonder who could have said that. Well, it turns out it was Neil Barringer. He said, the grass is greener where you water it. Oh no, hang on a minute. Wolfgang Puck said, people think that the grass is always greener over there, the grass is greener where you water it. But actually, hold on a minute. There is a wise philosopher who may have come before them and said, the grass ain't always greener on the other side, it's green where you water it. Justin Bieber. Obviously it's a popular saying, but what does it mean? I think it's about cultivation. Feeding the right thoughts and attitudes and guarding our hearts. So, a wider version of cultivating thankfulness. One thing to guard against, I don't know about you, but I'm always constantly amazed that advertising works, that people spend so much money advertising stuff, and it's such a big part of our culture. Ads telling us that something's fine, something's available is fine. We need to know to make our choice. But something that tells me I deserve it, or, I mean, we all know the L'Oreal thing, you're worth it. But there's more. I mean, just a sample here that say, you deserve the best, you deserve better, you deserve Spain, you deserve a break. How do they know what we deserve? I mean, I might be a thief, I could be a drug dealer, I could be a Daily Mail writer, I could be all sorts of things. I don't necessarily deserve it unless I've worked for it. Similarly, I object to adverts that try to make me dissatisfied with what I've got. God's been good to me. We've talked about satisfaction and gratitude. We're blessed. Let's appreciate what we have rather than struggle for something that we don't need. Thankfulness and gratitude generate contentment that causes peace. Now I'm going to be really, really, really quick on these. So quick you won't notice I've said them. But they're worth saying. To a degree we take this for granted, but I also want to say them because they tie in with covetousness and gratitude. I think sometimes covetousness gets fed by a sense of insecurity. You want something someone else has got because you feel you need it, or you'll go bust, or you won't be able to make ends meet, or whatever. And this feeling of insecurity is that it's a human thing. Even all through the Old Testament, the Israelites were going after other gods because they were hedging their bets about who's going to provide fertility for their crops. Sometimes we want what others have just to have a feeling of safety. We look at other people's things, or other people's, not necessarily just things, but their situation, their confidence, their jobs, their apparent wealth, because we think if we had that, we wouldn't worry so much. But that's we're looking in the wrong place. Jesus said, don't be anxious for your life, what you'll eat, yet for your body, what you'll wear. Gentiles seek after all these things. Your heavenly Father knows that you need them. A heavenly Father looks after us. So let's not look at the wrong place. Let's acknowledge and look for God's provision for us. I think the older we get, the more we see that when we look back. So that's one thing. Second thing, even quicker, justice. if inequality feeds covetousness, the bigger the gap between the rich and the poor, the more the poor are going to covet what the rich have got. So it's always a part of church culture. It should be ours, but I just put it up there that we should work towards justice to close the gap between rich and poor. Told you it's quick, it's gone now. And finally, remorse. We started off thinking about King David and Vladimir Putin. I don't think Putin's got the slightest remorse for what he's done in terms of the danger to other people, the death and destruction of property and lands and communities, the poverty he's bringing to Africa in various ways, let alone Ukraine. I don't know where it's got him. It's not gotten very far. He might be rich, but he's absolutely fierce for his life. No remorse. But David, when Nathan came to him and told him that parable we had at the end of the reading, David was gutted. He realized what he'd done. He realized how wrong it was. He absolutely was distraught before God. And God recognized that in his heart and forgave him. But just to say, if you've got issues, maybe it's someone you're lusting after or a situation you're lusting after and you realize you're looking in the wrong place, there is forgiveness, and God wants to clean us of those things and give us a fresh start. Sorry, I didn't summarize, did I? Just to say, covetousness, just to cover what we've covered then, covetousness changes lives, but God's heart is for us to thrive. Our response, four things we can do. One is to take time to appreciate what we have, be grateful, because we are really, really blessed, thank God. Two, ignore manipulative advertising. You probably do anyway, but just ignore it. Three, trust God for what we need. That's the tougher one, because that comes back to us all the time, where we're going to look for our provision. And finally, to use our resources for others.